32. When Ivan picked up Caro at the airport, he stared openly at her face.
What happened to you?
Caro asked him to tell everyone that she had walked into the edge of a door and didn't want to talk about it. That wouldn't stop some people, of course. Molly, Trevor, maybe Julian. She would tell Trevor what had happened. Everybody else could spread whatever delicious gossip they chose. A mugging. A fight with a secret lover on Grand Cayman. Resistance to an alien abduction. Whatever. It turned out that her request for privacy didn't stop Weigert, either. She went to thank him for his help in getting agreement for the project to implant Ellen. He said,
Caroline, what happened? Are you all right, my dear?
Julian said to not interrogate you, but...
He trailed off helplessly. She should have known Weigert would ask questions. Asking questions of the universe and everything in it, that was what he did. I'm fine, George, she said gently. Affection for the old man welled up in her. So sweet-natured, so brilliant. I walked into the edge of a door.
You should be more careful.
So innocent. I will, she said. The next day, it seemed to Caro that no one exhaled between 7 and noon. The entire compound held its collective breath while she and her surgical team worked on Samuel Lewis Watkins, Nobel laureate, ruthless genius, her great uncle. What had become routine was no longer. This surgery was low risk, compared to, say, a glioblastoma deep in the brain. But Watkins was old even for his actual age. He was dying from pancreatic cancer. And, Caro discovered, there was an oligodendroglioma, a cancer of the glial tissue, near the site where the leads would go. The slow-growing tumor, which had probably been there for years, hadn't shown up on the pre-op MRI. Although 70% of low-grade tumors eventually morphed into more aggressive tumors, Caro left the oligodendroglioma alone. Trevor concurred. Watkins would die long before the oligodendroglioma became a problem to him. It was a problem for her now, however. She had to maneuver around it to insert the leads, guided by the images on the screen at the end of the operating table. A suboptimally placed lead meant she would have to go in a second time to reposition it. That had not happened with any of her surgeries so far, and, in this case, it must not happen. Watkins would not survive a second procedure. Caro wasn't sure he would survive this one. But he did. By the time Caro asked Trevor to close, she had sweated a waterfall in the cold room. As she left the OR, she glimpsed Julian standing behind the glass of the tiny gallery. He met her in the scrub room.
Is he okay? Did it go all right?
Yes, Caro said. He's not going rollerblading or bungee jumping, but he came through okay. However, the risk isn't over, and the next 2 weeks are critical. He stays in the critical care unit, and nobody goes in except me, Trevor, Molly, and his nurses. Not even Camilla, who's not trained for this. I mean it, Julian. And don't try to discuss business with him by phone. Sometimes with these small holes for wire leads, air can enter the space between the brain and the skull and cause confusion for up to 2 weeks. You and George will have to make any necessary decisions without Watkins. Julian nodded. The rest of the day, she and Trevor took turns sitting with Watkins. Molly oversaw his morphine drip. Well, she said to Caro at mid-evening, a brain chip has not improved his personality. He's just a more bad-tempered version of himself, which I didn't think possible. Caro laughed, a weak gurgle. She was nerve-weary. It was amazing that Watkins had survived the surgery. It would be even more amazing if he recovered well enough to lie on the cot in Wing 3 and have a multiverse session. Caro, go rest, Molly said. You look as bad as Watkins does. Well, no, not quite, but rest now. She hugged Caro, who was surprised at how much comfort was brought her by the simple human touch of a friend. Watkins did not develop post-surgical complications, but neither did he recover as fast as Carol would have liked. Dr. Luskin moved temporarily into the compound, and how he could do that and still maintain a medical practice on Grand Cayman, Carol didn't ask. Watkins was a bad patient, brusque and fretful. The eighth or ninth time that he demanded an exact date when he could create a branch of the multiverse, she had difficulty restraining herself. "When I say so. You do understand that you're lucky to be alive at all, don't you? The hallucination delusion will just have to wait." To her surprise, he actually smiled.
"Call it that, do you? Your loss."
And then, surprisingly,
"Thank you, Caroline."
The next day, Trevor implanted Aiden, with Caro as backup. For the first time, the hospital had two patients at once, a harbinger of things to come. During Watkins's post-surgical recovery, neither Caro nor Trevor left the compound. They found ways to be together, although not yet in either of their bedrooms. Their growing attraction to each other would inevitably lead to sex, but Caro shied away from that. She wasn't... Wasn't what? She'd had casual affairs before. But that was the point. Intimacy with Trevor would not be casual. With the others, it had been sex. With Trevor, it would be making love. He didn't press her. Even though she'd never put into words why she was behaving as if she were 13 instead of 30. Finally, she put it into words for herself. She was afraid of loving him and being loved in return, of being that vulnerable to heartbreak. Only, didn't the endless talking that they'd so far substituted for sex render her even more vulnerable? Not at first. At first, it was all lighthearted excitement. More of a night owl than she, Trevor wrote her late each night, and each morning she woke in a glow of anticipation. The emails contained random anecdotes from his childhood, funny stories about his surgical residency, descriptions of his favorite cities, Venice and New York. Questions about her. What did she think of the president? Country Western music? Northern Italian cuisine? Did she like to cook? Watch football? Garden? Play chess? Go to the movies? What did she think of Louis Couture's furniture? "I've never thought at all about Louis Couture's furniture," she told him over lunch in the refectory.
"Good," he said. "I hate it. Prissy, fragile stuff."
"You like a good leather wing chair."
"Damn straight."
"What if I like Louis Couture's?" she said, and held her breath. This was the closest they'd ever come to suggesting a future where furniture tastes might matter.
"Then you should have it," he said.
And she was both relieved and unhappy at the ambiguous answer. She said, "I might like Louis Couture's beds. Although, I understand that Louis himself was always too busy while in it to actually look at his bed. That might be nice. Trevor, don't choke on that sandwich, because I don't remember how to do the Heimlich maneuver."
"And you call yourself a doctor."
"Who hates most, but not all, Louis Couture's furniture."
"That's not good, because I lied when I said I hated it. Have all Louis Couture's in my room. I had Sam put it in my contract."
"Damn. And all I got was heavy Tudor oak." Playfulness was safe, and it left her feeling buoyed up and cheerful for the entire day, even as it brought them closer. Until the night, the conversation changed. At nearly midnight, they sat at a picnic table in the Wing 1 courtyard. Only a few lights still shone from the windows, ringing the velvety darkness. Stars glittered around a crescent moon, small and curved as the paring from a child's fingernail. Caro sat across the table from Trevor, peering through the darkness to make out his features. She cupped her hands around her water glass, full of wine. Trevor, on call, had only actual water. They were talking of something inconsequential, although Caro's body reacted to his every remark as if it carried the fate of nations. Her pores tingled with him. Later, she could not even remember what their subject had been. There was no clear transition, unless it came from the night-blooming flowers beside the picnic table. Caro breathed in their scent, thought, too sickly sweet, and said abruptly, "Trevor, I had a brother who died."
"I know,"
he said gently. "But you don't know what happened afterward, what I did, what I caused." Even in the darkness, she felt his attention sharpen.
He said, "I'll know only if you want to tell me."
"I do. Ethan died in a car crash, and at his funeral, I wanted to. She lifted her glass to gulp her wine and found that Trevor was holding her hand. But she didn't need the wine. She needed to tell him, to make him understand who she really was and what was wrong with her. "There was a formal wake. After everyone had left, I bent to kiss Ethan goodbye in his coffin. My mother lost it. She screamed at me not to touch him. He was hers. It should have been me or Ellen that died instead. She wished it had been us." Ellen started crying, and my father just stood there like he always did, head down and silent. I screamed back at her that she was a bitch. She should die. I couldn't stop screaming. It all came out. All the years I knew she didn't love me or Ellen, only Ethan. All those years. She disinherited us. The money was hers, not my father's, and threw me out. Ellen was still in high school, so she stayed. But she was barely 17 and couldn't help our father with the clinical depression that deepened after Ethan died. Eventually, he killed himself. And then Ellen married a no-good.
"Stop,"
Trevor said, in a tone she'd never heard from him before. Anger. For a world-paralyzing moment, she thought the anger was directed at her.
"Caro, it was not your fault. None of it. I know, love, that you know what you're telling me is your emotional reality, not your rational beliefs. Emotions matter. Christ, do they matter. And I'm telling you, from my emotions, that you are lovable no matter what your mother said or did or didn't do. You are not responsible for your father's suicide or your sister's jailbreak marriage. Those kinds of actions are the result of years of behavior, not of something said at one funeral. Even if the something was a massive loss of temper after years of neglect and emotional abuse, you exploded spectacularly. But everybody does at some time.
Not you.
Oh God, why would you think that? You're wrong. I once."
He halted, and Caro saw that he labored under a memory at least as painful as hers. She said, because suddenly it was the most important thing she would ever hear, "Tell me."
"I lost it at a rock concert."
"At a rock concert?" "Yes." He took a while to go on.
"I think my rage, like yours, was a long time building. In Africa, I put back together child soldiers with missing arms, holes in their chests, feet that had been deliberately cut off, and worse, torture that I'm not going to tell you about. For months, I asked myself, why? Why so much hatred? So much cruelty? And eventually, everybody who stays there, a lot don't, learns the answer, which is that there is no answer, not really. There are long-standing historical and political reasons. There are horrendous individual experiences warping people, but there isn't any really good answer why the torturer does it, why he enjoys it, All I could do was accept it and do what I could. And then I came back to the States on leave, stayed with my sister, and took my nephew to a rock concert. Some terrible punk band in a not very big venue. But Gabe idolized the lead singer, the way kids do. And he brought along his cherished guitar that he'd just gotten for Christmas. My sister scrimped and saved to buy it. She's a widow, and neither of us ever had much money. The lead singer leaned down from the stage and asked if he could see the guitar. Gabe was thrilled. An 11-year-old handing over his guitar to this guy he admired. The singer took the guitar, played a few chords, and then smashed it onto the stage, grinning, and the crowd howled and cheered. I looked at Gabe's face, and I lost it. I climbed onto the stage and grabbed the guy and got in two good punches to the face before security dragged me away. They got in their punches too. And if a kind woman hadn't taken Gabe out of the place and found me, I don't know what would have happened. But I wasn't just punching that asshole who'd smashed a kid's prized guitar. I was punching every monster in Africa who'd recruited kids as soldiers, or shot them, or cut off their arms, or all the rest of the senseless cruelty over there. But of course, my stupid action didn't help them, or even Gabe, who saw his uncle give in to violence that helped not at all. Caro moved around the picnic bench, put her arms around him, and hung on. This was a side of Trevor she hadn't seen before. The reverse side of idealism. Pain when you failed your own ideals. They stayed that way for several minutes before she said, "Make love to me, Trevor. Please." He pulled away to peer at her face. Moonlight glinted off his glasses. "Are you finally sure?" "Yes. Because of what you just told me about yourself. Because you know enough about me to even ask that question. Because I love you. Because I can love you." Quick the first time, slow the second, sweeter than even her imaginings. She didn't even need to say or hear, "I love you." They both knew.